This land is your land. This land is mine. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you.
Hello, everyone. This is Basma Farhat on the People Speak radio show. I'm afraid John Neal, my co-host, can't be with us this evening. He's a little bit under the weather, and hopefully we send out good wishes to John. We are working with Pal Talk at www.paltalk.com. Please join us by downloading and installing the software and creating a nickname. You can join us in our virtual audience where you can participate and talk to our guests or listen to us on our new network broadcasting station, BBS Radio, at bbsradio.com. Our guest tonight is Tenzin Tithong, a representative of the Dalai Lama. Mr. Tithong is with the Dalai Lama Foundation here in the USA. He is also the former the Prime Minister de facto of Tibet, but we'll clarify all that with him as soon as he comes on. We will be taking a short break right now for some public service announcements, and we will be right back with Mr. Tithong. Hello, welcome back, everybody, to the People Speak radio show on BBS Radio and Pal Talk at www.paltalk.com. Tonight our guest is a gentleman of great distinction and honor. He was the former representative of the Dalai Lama in New York and Washington. Mr. Tenzin Tithong of the Dalai Lama Foundation has been very active. He's also, and I'm going to try to pronounce this, Mr. Tithong, the Kalan Tripa.
Yes.
And the head of the Kashag, the cabinet of the Dalai Lama that was in the exiled government.
Right.
Welcome to our show, sir.
Thank you.
Mr. Tithong, can you talk to us briefly about the Dalai Lama Foundation here in the United States, how it originated, what some of the goals are, and what some of the strategies are, briefly, as far as your return to from exile, or the Dalai Lama's, or is it just specifically for that?
Well, let me explain. The Dalai Lama Foundation is a few years old, and it's been started by a number of you might call students and friends of the Dalai Lama. People who have worked with him in the past, people who have known him, done interviews with him, or have written about him, and people who have worked with Tibetan refugees, exiles. And while the foundation carries his name, the Dalai Lama Foundation, it really is not about the Dalai Lama, but the main focus of the foundation is on peace and ethics. The group of people who set this foundation want to do some work in the area of peace. They want to make their personal contributions towards making the world a little more peaceful, more ethical. So that's very briefly the main sort of the purpose of the foundation and the people behind it.
And what are some of the strategies that the foundation is using to create peace in such an unpeaceful and unrestful world these days, Mr. Tithong?
Well, the people involved in the foundation so far, many of the founding members, the board of directors, some of our close donors and friends and volunteers, we have decided that maybe the best investment we can make in our work for peace is to focus on, in the area of education. And we've we believe that maybe our efforts will become most beneficial if we try to do work that is going to be educational in nature about peace, to see what we can do to create more awareness about the issues of peace, and also to educate our current and future generations about the values of peace. So we're trying to focus on educational materials for peace.
Which obviously is the only way that we can create any of this. I think awareness and building awareness and educating people as to how these strategies, where are some of the work that the foundation is working out of? I mean, are you working through universities and?
Well, right now, we are just, you know, since we are fairly new, we are just beginning to branch out and talk to individuals and organizations that are already engaged in this area. And we are so beginning to reach out to universities and other groups in educational institutions. And what we are doing in terms of education is we are developing some educational materials for high school and middle school kids. We are also trying to, we have started to produce some online courses that will be available through our foundation. And we have been, shall we say, encouraging and promoting study circles on books that deal with peace. One of our first set of study circles has been people who've gotten together to study a book called Ethics for the New Millennium. This is a book by the Dalai Lama, but it's not about Buddhism or Tibet. It's essentially a collection of some of his ideas about what we can do to make the world a little better. And so it is on issues of peace and ethics and universal responsibility. So in these sort of lines where we're putting our effort. And one major sort of educational project that we have launched is that we have been co-sponsors of an art exhibition called The Missing Piece, and it's subtitled Artists Consider the Dalai Lama. But the primary focus of that exhibition is about peace in its many aspects. So this is a big traveling exhibition which we hope to take internationally. Currently, it's just concluded its first 3 months showing at the Fowler Museum at UCLA.
Mm-hmm.
It will go to Chicago next month. It will be there for about 3 months at the Loyola University Art Museum. And then it's going to New York in March for a longer run of approximately 6 months. And after that, we hope to see it go to Europe or Asia.
Oh, wonderful. Let me ask you now, am I mistaken? Did I hear you say that this was actually art by the Dalai Lama?
No, this is an art exhibition that has some 88 artists from all over the world who have contributed.
I see.
Art ranging from photography to paintings to installation art. And I'm very happy to say that it seems to be very well received by people in the art world. Since, you know, we're not art experts, but we did go about and invite professional curators and well-known artists to contribute their work. So this is an educational piece, and we've tried to make this exhibition with peace as a theme to be inspirational and, you know, exciting. And at the same time, we've produced some simple educational materials, such as posters and other things for young people who come to the exhibition.
Wonderful. That sounds like an excellent project. And what more prominent a way or important a way to spread cultural beliefs and peace under a Dalai Lama Foundation but through art? That is an excellent project, and I wish you all the best with it. Congratulations on such an endeavor. Let me ask you, Mr. Tissong, what were some of the things that you worked with as a representative of the Dalai Lama? Were you involved in his, obviously you, there's a spiritual basis for all the work that you do. And how were you, how did you become connected with the Dalai Lama and the history that you had with him?
Well, I'm a Tibetan, and I was a Tibetan refugee in India. So from a fairly young age, I was naturally involved in and grew up in the exile community, which is largely based in India. And so I started to work within the exile administration that took care of Tibetan refugees and that was concerned with the preservation of a Tibetan culture, and also trying to carry out a human rights and political fight for the people of Tibet, the vast majority who are still in Tibet. And it's through that work that I became involved in the administration, which is to the vast majority of Tibetans, the legitimate sort of government of Tibet in exile under the Dalai Lama. And so I came to work for His Holiness the Dalai Lama as his representative in New York some 20 years ago, when there was a small office that was set up to appeal the Tibetan case before the United Nations. It had successfully raised the Tibetan issue on one or two occasions at the United Nations General Assembly. But by the early 70s, when I got to New York, it was basically being shut down because the United States policies towards China had changed by then, and Tibet and the Tibetan case was basically being abandoned and discarded by the United States government.
They have done in many cases when it is no longer a primary prerequisite of their country.
That's right.
Was this before you were appointed director of the program and development?
This is, as I said, more than 20 years ago.
I see.
And basically, that's when I was representing the Dalai Lama and trying to create some basis of public support and concern for the people of Tibet and the future of Tibet. And it's through that work, I represented the Dalai Lama and tried to reach out to the academic community, the media, and the political world in Washington, D.C.
Right. So you know, as a Palestinian American, I understand the nature of refugeeism as a status, and it's a difficult process, and I understand it. Having refugees in both India and Nepal, do you find that running a government, and this is one thing that I find very interesting, is the running of a government in exile. How does one run a government in exile? And where do you meet? What is your quote unquote White House, so to speak? It sounds like an unusual situation. And do you really have any impact on the people in the Tibetan community, being a government de facto?
Well, running a government in exile is an extremely challenging and difficult thing to do. But as I said right in the beginning, for the vast majority of the Tibetan people, when the Dalai Lama left Tibet, he and his administration, no matter how small or large it was, represented the legitimate government of the Tibetan people. So when the Dalai Lama became a refugee and came to India, one of his immediate concerns was to see what could be done for the streams of new refugees coming out of Tibet, especially children. Mm-hmm. And so the administration that grew around him became, for all practical purposes, the government in exile. Now, because of the politics of China, the way world politics has gone, and because China as a important world player. Nobody in the world recognized this exile government. But because it continued to serve a function for the Tibetan people, and because the Dalai Lama maintained the integrity and legitimacy of his work, it took on the meaning of a government in exile. And furthermore, I think he added the dimension in which he refused to just run things his way, even though he was very popular and well-respected by the Tibetan people. Right from the early years of exile in the 1960s, 61, he asked the exile community to elect their own representatives, and he laid the foundation for the exile administration to become a democratic institution.
Mm-hmm.
So we could do all that because India, as you know, is an open and democratic society. And even though we
were able to maintain the sovereignty of the Tibetan administration within the exile community in India.
That's right. Even though we were not recognized by the Indian government officially, since we were not doing anything illegal or unlawful, we were simply assembling democratically, doing things democratically within the, you know, structures of Indian law. We were able to function as a democratic government in exile.
I see. And it's still, and still maintain a certain amount of autonomy.
Yes.
Within the government.
Yes, very much.
And isn't that really what the Dalai Lama and his and the government of Tibet wanted to see happen with China, and still does, if I'm not mistaken?
That's right. right now, all of Tibet and the majority of the Tibetan people are essentially part of the People's Republic of China.
Mm-hmm.
The Tibetans contest that this is an forced arrangement, and that Tibet is occupied, and the Tibetans are living under the Chinese administration without our consent.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're trying to find a political solution to this, and the Dalai Lama is trying to offer whatever reasonable compromise he can to bring about a solution.
Mm-hmm.
But the Chinese government, as run by the Chinese Communist Party, is holding a very rigid position on this, which very briefly can only be explained as being very colonial and very chauvinistic, and certainly least undemocratic.
Oh, absolutely. Anytime an occupying force imposes its ideologies and status on you, then of course it is an anti-democratic society and no longer a democratic society. Let me ask you something, Mr. Tesong. Does the fact that these Tibetans living in this plateau area, that they know that there is an allegiance still to the Dalai Lama and the government of the Dalai Lama,
mm-hmm.
How much distress does this cause the Tibetans? I mean, is there any kind of sanctions or problems that they would incur? I mean, as far as like being unfairly treated and targeted,
oh, yes,
due to this, and how do you deal with that?
Because the Tibetans choose to maintain their identity, and because the vast majority of the Tibetans have refused to accept Chinese domination. The Chinese government has obviously been very strict in response. So through the 50s and early 70s, the Chinese government used extreme hard tactics to control the Tibetans, everything from executions to mass imprisonments to labor camps to the utter destruction of Tibetan monasteries and temples, basically overhauling the entire social and political structure of Tibet and trying to introduce a whole new language and culture. But by now, especially after Deng Xiaoping came into power and China itself was restructured, the Tibetan people and the Tibetan culture has not died away completely. The people in Tibet, despite these extreme experiences that they've had to go through, have survived, and their sort of commitment to Tibetan community, Tibetan society, Tibetan language and culture still remains very strong. But the tension is still there, and every now and then when Chinese policies fluctuate depending on what's happening internally or internationally, they clamp down on the Tibetans. They come down on the Tibetans very hard. So these days, in many parts of Tibet, especially what's considered the central parts of Tibet,
yes,
people are not even allowed to have a picture of the Dalai Lama in private or in, especially in public places. You can get into serious trouble, imprisonment, and other things. And if any Tibetan is to raise his voice about an issue that's cultural or ethnocentric or definitely political, I think imprisonment and fear punishment is just around the corner. So there's a tremendous amount of tension and difficulty that Tibetans have to face day to day.
Well, as in many areas of the world, let me ask you something. Do you think that the movie 7 Years in Tibet, that you and for our viewing audience, for those of you that don't know, Mr. Tesong was the advisor on the film 7 Years in Tibet. Excuse me. And as an advisor, this film, do you think, being, you know, as obviously as true as you can possibly get in film, do you think that this has helped or hindered the issue of Tibet?
Well, I think it's probably helped more than hindered. It's created some understanding and awareness of Tibet in many circles, especially people who like movies or young people who went to see it because Brad Pitt was in it. But generally, I think it's helped because 7 Years in Tibet is based on a true story and a book called 7 Years in Tibet. And by and large, the story is accurate. Certain aspects of the story has been heightened a bit. Maybe the fact that Henry Kara, the main character, his selfishness may have been sort of heightened a little bit to add more drama to the story. And some of the behaviors of the Chinese generals when they first came to Tibet, some of those scenes may be exaggerated a little bit to show, you know, the explosive tension. But by and large, the story is quite accurate, and it tells of a sort of a tragic period in Tibetan history through the story of this mountaineer who was in the Himalayas when the Second World War broke out. And he was, you know, interned by the British and came to Tibet. And not only did he see a part of Tibetan history when it was confronted by modern-day China, but also how this Austrian mountaineer changed, you know, at a person, at an individual level, how Tibetan culture impacted him.
Very interesting. Did you actually work with Brad, and what were his ideas? Was the Dalai Lama involved in this in any way, just maybe giving his blessings?
I don't think the Dalai Lama was involved in it, I'm sure he gave it his blessings.
Do you think he watched it?
I'm not sure. I'm sure he may have. You know, these days you can watch good movies on DVDs.
This is true.
And, I did get to, of course, meet Brad Pitt and many of the other actors there. It had quite an international cast, you know, a very good English actor who... David Thewlis, who played the other Austrian mountaineer who escaped with Hara. We had the recently passed away, the Japanese-American actor Marco. We had B.D. Wong. We had a famous Indian Sikkimese actor from India. So there was a very good international.
I understand the film track itself, the soundtrack was amazing as well.
Yeah.
If I'm not mistaken, I think Yo-Yo Ma was one of the cellists that played part of the.
He had some pieces in it, and I think John Williams was the musical director.
Yes, he was.
More than all of them, I think the key person behind this film was the French director, Jean-Jacques Annaud.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one who, you probably know, who did The Rose and Quest for Fire. And I believe he was very eager to do this film because he was interested in the preservation of traditional and ancient cultures and societies, and he thought this story had something to say about that, and it was in this context that he found the film an exciting project. And he was also very particular and precise about how we portrayed Tibet. He wanted a great deal of authenticity in the costumes, in the architecture, and also in the body language. So while the screenplay was written by a well-known screenplay writer in Hollywood, we also went through the details of the dialogue, not just so that the language and the expression conveyed some sense of Tibetan-ness other than just English words.
Yeah.
So there was a great deal of attention paid to getting a right feeling of how
as much authenticity as you could possibly create.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's wonderful. It sounds like an amazing film, people. And again, I am hoping that it has brought awareness to a very devastated area of the world. Again, how many devastated areas are there? It's almost what I would call a crying shame. Or a criminal shame, what is happening in many of the world communities, including and no less than the Tibetan community, which has been very, very and extremely devastated by all of this. We're going to be taking a break in for a minute. And when we come back, you'll be able to participate by calling our toll-free number here at the BBS broadcasting station. The toll-free number is 877-876-5227, or worldwide toll-free is 888-810-8322. And when we return from our break right now, we'll be asking some more questions of Mr. Tithong, the former representative of the Dalai Lama. And if there are any questions that you'd like to ask, please call those numbers again. Again, 877-876-5227 or 888-810-8322. And we'll be right back. Welcome back to our show, The People Speak. When the people speak, we make a difference. Our guest tonight is Tenzin Tithong of the Dalai Lama Foundation, the former representative of the Dalai Lama here in the United States. And we do have a caller. Let's see what our first question is. And we'll be continuing with our interview with Mr. Tithong. Caller, if you'll give us your first name and where you're calling from and a brief question for the representative of the Dalai Lama, Mr. Tithong.
Hello, Mr. Tithong. My name is Mike. I'm in California. My question is, I understand that the Dalai Lama is visiting the United States and I believe Canada. Have you had a chance to meet with him, and what has been his itinerary? What has been some of the highlights of his visit here? Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mike, and that's a great question. Go right ahead, Mr. Tithong.
Yes, I didn't meet him personally at the time, but I did attend one or two of his events. He was in Vancouver about 10 days ago, Vancouver, Canada, for a series of meetings with people who were, had some programs with young children and educators on issues of peace. And after that, he was in Pasadena, California, for a 3-day teaching for some Buddhist groups. This is primarily a Buddhist group's teaching. And I was able to attend these two events. And while in Pasadena, one afternoon, he did give a public talk at the Gibson Theater in Universal City. After that, I believe he was in Denver for 2 days, attending an event called Peace Jam, where 12 other Nobel laureates came. And I believe Peace Jam is an organization that works mostly with children and young people, and their efforts are to do with peace and promoting peace. They had 12 Nobel laureates speaking as well. And right now, I believe he's at the, probably towards the end of his visit to the U.S. this time, I think he's going to be at the University of, State University of New York in Buffalo, in upstate New York. So his trips are a mix of giving teachings or lectures to Buddhist groups, to responding to invitations from universities and other institutions.
Well, thank you. We'll be taking calls from our audience as the interview goes on. Remember, The People Speak is the name of the show, so give us a call and please join us. Mr. Titsong, let me ask you, talk to us about the Dalai Lama. Talk to us about your impressions of him, your relationship with him, and how is, in light of the cataclysmic crises that I believe that the world is facing right now, with global wars, the rage over the recent papal comments about Islam, how does the Dalai Lama fit into all of this? And what are his views, if you have any insight on them?
Well, I think he fits into what is happening in the world today, especially in terms of the need for a person like the Dalai Lama. And by that I mean, clearly, first of all, we are in a time of tremendous conflict at various levels, not just human conflicts, but our conflicts with the environment and how the world is evolving into, whether it's going to be a just society or not. And I think the whole process of globalization is also something that has a tremendous impact now. We are no longer separated by distance or by continents. And whatever is happening in one part of the world is almost having an immediate impact in the opposite side of the globe.
Absolutely.
And with all these conflicts, we need leadership, and we need voices that are true, authentic, and without hidden agendas. And I think that's also something difficult to come by in many respects. So the Dalai Lama, I'm not saying he's the only one, but he is among a few whose concerns are sort of universal. What he speaks for is for the good of everybody. His concerns are quite authentic. He is somebody with some integrity, as proven by his lifetime work with Tibetan refugees and Tibetan exiles, and the complex relationship with China. So I think that's his role. So when he travels, usually his work in terms of calling for support for Tibet or greater understanding for Buddhism is very limited. Often he prefers to speak mainly on the commonality of all peoples everywhere and his sort of personal interest and concern for what we can do individually to make the world better and more just.
I think that's an interesting statement in and of itself, and I think that a lot of times as myself, an activist in the peace community, we many times get frustrated. We get to the point where, you know, it's it's disheartening to see that all of our work may or may not be working. And for us, and for me especially, I find that the issue of individual impact on the world is something that I have to that I get through my own spiritual base. I generally don't get it from my political base because as in politics, generally the theme is that we go under a majority, but with spirit, it is always an individual basis. So I think that's what helps me. We have an interesting and a diverse audience in that we have a virtual auditorium that I am witnessing right now, Mr. Tithong. And one of the questions, and we are being asked some questions here in the virtual audience, and one of the questions is from a friend of the People Speak, Dennis the Menace. He goes under that nickname in the chat room. And his question to you is, what is Jesus's relationship to Buddhism?
I'm not a scholar of Christianity nor of Buddhism, really, so I don't have specific and factual information to state any real connection of Jesus to Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know that a small segment of the Tibetans in the past have had connections to Christianity, and there's a very small Christian community in Tibet as well. And many people of Tibetan ethnicity and cultural background on the Tibetan plateau, both on the eastern end and the western end, have been exposed to Christianity, and there are links to this faith. But more important, I think, than if there's any connection between Jesus and Buddhism, is that the central message of love and compassion, I think, is pretty much the same.
Exactly.
That is maybe the connection that needs to be understood and appreciated more than anything else.
Well, in light of that, let me ask you. You know, obviously we all understand that there is an incredible resurgence to fundamentalist belief systems throughout all of the religions. And I'm not so sure how fundamentalism is aiding the situation in my own view. I don't know that it is. With Buddhism, it's a different, I almost want to call it a different style of spirituality, in that it is all embracive.
Well,
isn't fundamentalist the basic premise of Buddhism?
Well, you know, I think anybody in a particular faith will probably at some stage say, my faith is the best.
My God is better than your God.
Yes. But I think in this relation, it's good to just to relate a little bit about the Dalai Lama's views about Buddhism and its connection to all the other religious faiths.
Mm-hmm.
He is a person who believes that all the religious traditions in the world have an important role to play, and that all religious traditions have played an important role for the betterment of humanity. So what he says is that he still believes all the different religious traditions obviously have a very important role, because you look at the impact people in different parts of the world identify themselves, often primarily by their spiritual tradition of it they belong to. And so he says this opportunity where there's a spirituality that people sort of identify with should not be squandered. And at the same time, he says, of course there are differences. It doesn't mean we should all be, shall we say, sort of wishy-washy and say everything is the same. He said, in fact, if we sort of debate or think only on a philosophical level, there are major differences, and you will never come to any conclusion, because, you know, some faiths like Buddhism and Jainism don't even accept the concept of a creator God, whereas many of the major religions such as, you know, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, are monotheistic. So he says this is something that's sort of an issue. disagree, but look at what the rest of spiritual traditions mean to an individual. And he says, it seems always to say, if you follow well in this tradition, you will become gentler, you will become kinder, you will be more accepting. And he says, this is what sort of the essence of life is, you know, compassion and love is maybe the essence of what human beings strive for and need. So he says, on that level, there's so many things we can do. He has a sort of a few steps that he personally follows, begins with, first of all, studying each other's tradition better so that you have some genuine understanding and respect. Then he talks about dialogue and exchanging spiritual and mystical experiences, which he does with, you know, Catholic monks and people of other traditions. And then he also says, I try to go to spiritual places of other traditions, and he often cites his visits to Rome and Jerusalem and other Hindu sites, and he says, each time I go there, I actually feel that I can sense some kind of a deep spiritual, you know, sort of presence. So he uses that as a basis for people of spirit to come together, because the world needs it and humanity needs it. So that's sort of the take on, how should we say, not take my explanation about what the Dalai Lama feels about spirituality and how the relationship should be between different faiths.
Let me ask you, how do you see, I know for myself that I've always had the impression that our eventual path would lead us to some kind of a marriage between spirituality and government. I don't believe, as a person that is deeply entrenched in spiritualism, I don't believe that we have the capacity quite yet on a global scale to engage in that kind of a relationship. Do you agree that that would be the ultimate, and how would a world work, and how would we blend spirituality and government? I mean, coming from a government of Tibet that obviously has a spiritual leader as the very premise of its society, how does that work?
Well, again, I don't know if my personal views are that sort of profound or in-depth. But I do share some of the thoughts that the Dalai Lama, you know, expresses on this issue. First of all, although he traditionally has been regarded as both the spiritual and political head of Tibet, even today he's revered that way, he thinks the more modern concept of separation of church and state is better for...
Really? That's very interesting.
Management of secular, you know, administration. But that means the ideas of a spiritual tradition, you know, compassion, equality, justice, and all that, that shouldn't be abandoned. That should be incorporated somehow. But the administration or the running of a social organization like a government and the political life need not be guided by a spiritual tradition. I think that's he has a view that way. So so I'm not sure if espousing a spiritual sort of you know, track for politics and spirituality to merge at some point is the answer in the future. It doesn't seem to be that way. Anyway, I'm already influenced by what he has said. Yeah.
I think we're all influenced by a lot of what the Dalai Lama says. Myself, as a believer in many of the paths that he tries to instill in the world, am concerned that maybe his voice isn't as loud as I would like to see him.
Yeah.
Or as prominent in the community You hear about the papal community, you hear about Islam, you hear about the Jerry Falwells, the rightists, and the evangelicals. Do you think that there's going to be more power placed or burden of responsibility placed on the Dalai Lama in the future in regards to his position as one of the great spiritual leaders of the world?
No, I'm not sure about that. Of course, there's a lot of expectations of him whenever, you know, there's some difficult issues we all have to deal with, and we expect him to have some clear-cut answers.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's sort of a burden on him in that respect, but he does not necessarily, shall we say, offer immediate solutions. He is fully aware of the complexities of all we are going through, but he does encourage more openness, tolerance, and the ability to communicate more. And so even in this time of, for example, great debate about clash of civilization and Islam as being militant, he's often in the forefront, sort of, he said, like, I feel like I'm going to be a defender for Islam, because he says, I know that you can't equate the wrong things that are going on with a religious tradition. Often he would say, in many religious traditions, we have mischievous people espousing very extreme views, and all of us need to be aware of that. So he, you know, he's able to sort of play that role also.
I really appreciate the word mischievous and your use of it.
That's the word he uses because, you know, the Dalai Lama's English is not. It's not his first language, definitely. And
oh, but it's beautiful. I wish that perhaps that we could all use such benevolent terms in describing what a lot of people would just see as the Antichrist on Earth anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of the Antichrist, do you believe that there is an Antichrist at work?
No.
Or the concept of the Antichrist.
I don't believe that, you know. Well, since I guess I have to say, since I'm not a Christian and I don't believe in Christ as a savior, therefore I don't have this idea of an Antichrist. Personally, you know, I am generally, I think, optimistic that we as human beings can evolve into something much more positive than what we've been doing the last 100 years or so, because our longer history has proven that maybe we are improving in many areas. Slow, but we are making changes that point to some very positive aspects of, you know, our common development.
Well, this has been fascinating. Do you anticipate seeing the Dalai Lama again, or is this just the part of your life that is moving you forward?
To see the Dalai Lama again?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, certainly. I will see him, I think, many more times. He is 71 years old right now, but he's, I think, a very fit and a very alert 71-year-old, and he's also very enthusiastic about what little bit he thinks he's doing for a better world. And so I expect to see him at symposiums and lectures, and also in his work for the Tibetan exiles and his work for, you know, sort of this interreligious activity that he's engaged in. So I think we'll see and hear still quite a bit more from him.
Well, this has been wonderful, sir. This has been an incredible honor having you on. Our guest tonight has been Tenzin Tsang of the Dalai Lama Foundation. Mr. Tsang was the former representative of the Dalai Lama, and we appreciate having you with us. We wish you luck. with all of your endeavors, including the Dalai Lama Foundation, which is an incredible organization from everything we've been able to see. We have been, just for your information, for the information of our viewing audience, been posting the links to all of these organizations, including the Dalai Lama Foundation, in our virtual auditorium. And we thank you. I'd like to let everybody know that our guest next week is going to be an incredible young man. He is a rapper that has a message. The name of this gentleman is Immortal Technique. He's a socially conscious rapper, and he'll be our guest next week on the People Speak radio show. I would like to thank BBS Broadcasting, Pal Talk Radio, Internet Radio. I would like to thank Mr. Tisong. And what we will be doing is closing for the evening. And I want to thank you again, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
It's been wonderful having you. And blessings to you and to your endeavors.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
One bright sunny morning in the shadow of the city wall, by the relief of fast, I saw my people, and they stood there hungry, stood there wondering if this land was made for you and me. This land is yours. This land is my land, from California to the New York Island, Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water. Yeah, this land is made for you and me.